Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you click on that events page, because 2021 is the year that you go back to events. That's what we think, anyway. In April, you can start that in April. In the spring, it's new beginnings, it's new life, it's new event in NWA. This Northwest Arkansas regional event is 2 days. Eric will be there, I'll be there, a whole bunch of other people will be there. 2 day conference. It's only $65 for a 2 day event in Bentonville, Arkansas. Would love to have you there. Go over to the events page, get all the information. And also, of course, what we do in Here We Still Stand general conference in October. You want to get that ticket, obviously, before the first of the year so you can get it on the early bird special. You want to get the cheapest price you can. And so the cheapest price is available until January 1st. So it's been a year, and next year is going to be a different year, a year where you hopefully go to these two events. Eric, what's going on, man?
Oh, what's going on at the present moment is we're all sort of hunkering down, getting ready for the first real big storm of the winter coming tomorrow.
Beat you to it.
So that means that everybody is shopping. You know, everybody's getting milk, bread, eggs, and probably booze. But yeah.
We already got the big storm, dude. I saw that.
I saw you were hooping it, hooping around playing in the storm.
Yeah, dude. We got a bunch of snow, built snowmen, all that stuff. This is early for snow for us. I think it was just recently on the podcast we were talking about how great the weather was here. It was like upper 60s every day, and then a cold front moved in and just dumped, you know, 7 inches of snow in my yard. And so that's fun. We do not usually get snow before the first of the year. Usually if we get snow, we get snow every year, but usually that's a January, February kind of thing, not before Christmas usually. So a little surprise snow for us, and not just a little bit, quite a bit.
That's fun, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been looking forward to the snow. I mean, we got a little bit last week. I do like it this time of year. I like it in December, you know, makes you feel all Christmassy, et cetera. Yeah. And I'm even okay with it into January, and then February,
you're done,
the snow comes and I'm like, go away. But it doesn't go away until April. It just doesn't.
February's the worst. February, at least where I live, February is when I'm officially sick and tired of the cold. And I'm just like, come on, March, let's go. Because here, March is really, I mean, our spring is March, April, May. Our summer.
So you guys actually follow like a real, you know, sort of seasonal calendar where it's a bit extended out here. Winter is a bit longer.
Yeah, March, April, May is spring. June, July, August, summer. September, October, November, fall. December, January, February is winter as far as that's how it feels.
That
outside.
Sounds rational.
Yeah, it sounds rational.
Makes sense.
In equal proportions. But yeah, by February, I'm like, yeah, I'm done.
Yeah.
And we don't get that much snow or anything. It's just I'm just not someone who loves the cold. I can deal with it for a little while, but about the third month I'm ready for the sun to come back out and do its thing. So that's why you want to come to Northwest Arkansas in April. I mean, that's when the flowers are blooming. It's gorgeous in April, so come on.
I'm looking forward to it, man. And I'm looking forward to diving into today's text. We're in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. We left off last time with Paul still sort of making his appeal to the Corinthian church to make sure that they, well, basically held up to their end of the deal. And that's a crass way of putting it. But basically, they had pledged to Paul that they were going to give a certain amount in an offering for the church in Jerusalem that was struggling and impoverished. And Paul is about to make good on that. He's about to come and collect that. And he's sort of, you know, just urging them, make sure you're ready for that. Make sure it's okay. Now we move into something that we've alluded to a lot throughout this letter, Dan, and that is Paul defending his ministry. It's something that sort of it shades everything before it, and it certainly shades everything after it. Chapter 10 is really where he wears his heart on his sleeve and makes a defense for what he's doing, because his ministry, of course, is under attack amongst some of the Corinthians in the church there. So he writes, "I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am humble when face to face with you, but bold toward you when I am away. I beg of you that when I am present, I may not have to show boldness with such confidence as I count on showing against some who suspect us of walking according to the flesh." Now, it's important to point out here right up front, Dan, that in verse 1, where he says, "I who am humble when face to face with you, but bold toward you when I am away," is really him using sarcasm. this is something that he was being accused of, that he would speak with a big voice, you know, via letter. But then when he gets in front of you face to face, well, he backs down and is all nice and kind. And Paul says, well, I know that that's the accusation about me. But the truth is, I don't want to come and have to tear into you guys when I see you. I don't get to see you very often. And I don't want to have to deal with this. Although I do recognize, he says in verse 2, I am going to have to be bold with some people who, quote, suspect us of walking according to the flesh.
Yeah, so basically he's saying that there's some people, these would be these sort of super apostle influenced people or super apostles themselves, that are accusing him of doing everything for selfish gain and power and influence and all this stuff, which, if you know the life of Paul, is sort of preposterous on his face. But you have to understand that, you know, these guys aren't thumbing through the book of Acts. They're not, you know, they don't have the whole thing, different time, different place, you know. So they're like, hey, I don't know if you know, but Paul is doing all kinds of stuff other places, and they're just making stuff up about him. And yeah, I know he seems like he's all meek and gentle, and like he has your best interest when he's here, but you don't even understand. Like he's a totally different person when he's away from here. This kind of stuff is, you know, it's insidious now, of course, and we have like the opposite problem where you can just say this kind of stuff on social media or whatever, blast it out to the entire world, which is a problem. But the problem here is that this stuff is harder to refute back then, because I mean it can spread way
for months.
It can spread way really far before you ever hear of it, and then you have to write a letter and send it. And I mean it's a real problem, and so people are taking advantage of the fact that he's not there to defend himself and making up all kinds of junk about him.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so he says this in his beginning to his response to all of that, for though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. Now, when he says we walk in the flesh, he's not saying we walk in sin. He's actually literally saying like, yes, I walk in a body.
Right.
But I'm not waging war according to the way that the body would naturally do so. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, swords, axes, you know, whatever they might use for a weapon back then, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ, being ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is complete.
You know, it's interesting about this text. This is probably a text that a lot of people are familiar with. You know, you've probably heard the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. You know, you've probably heard that. Take every thought captive. You might have heard correct or incorrect things said about this text. But rarely is this text talked about in context, where he's actually talking about people lying about him and how he's going to go to war with that, with the truth and divine power, and destroy all the arguments that are being made against him.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I love this text because it's so different than the way we're prone to thinking about fighting a battle. The battle, it's actually a great apologetics text too, Dan. I mean, for those especially who are really interested in the subject, this is one of those things where if you're doing apologetics well, this is part of what you're doing. You're taking the arguments that are brought against the gospel, against what God's word says, and you're trying to make sure that you take those and show how they are not worthy to go up against what the gospel presents us with.
Yeah, what's interesting too is that he doesn't just say like, and I'm going to defend myself by dismantling all their arguments against me. He does say that he's going to destroy arguments, but he also says he's going to destroy every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God. And so he's saying not only is like, it's not just like my reputation that's at stake here. These people are teaching you false things about God. So these are lofty opinions, as he says. They're not true. They're just opinions. And they go against what is true about God. And so he's going to go out to destroy those and take every thought captive to obey Christ. So he's going to take all these thoughts about God, these opinions about God, and he's going to take them captive and dismantle them.
Yeah, and so when he says being ready to punish every disobedience, what he's speaking of specifically in the context here is the disobedience that is being manifested by those who are slandering him and those who are with him in presenting this message of the gospel.
Yeah. I mean, so like one of the ways you hear this, and this is all in with good intentions, but you know, someone will be like, oh, I'm just under so much stress, or I'm so struggling with so much anxiety. And they'll be like, take every thought captive. Just take your thoughts captive. Yeah. This is not have anything to do with what Paul is talking about. I understand the sentiment there. I understand that this is said with good intentions. Not what Paul is talking about. He is not instructing you to take every single thought that you've ever had captive and think about whether or not it is in, if it lines up with obedience to Christ. This is not what he's talking about. He is talking about taking false teaching and lies about him and about the knowledge of God and taking those things captive and then systematically destroying them.
Yes, now that's precisely correct. So again, one of those instances where context helps us understand more clearly a very commonly recited verse. So he moves on in verse 7, look at what is before your eyes. If anyone is confident that he is Christ's, let him remind himself that just as he is Christ's, so also are we. For even if I boast a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I will not be ashamed. I do not want to appear to be frightening you with my letters. For they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech of no account. Let such a person understand that what we say by letter when absent, we do when present. Not that we dare to classify or compare ourselves with some of those who are commending themselves, but when they measure themselves by one another and compare themselves with one another, they are without understanding. So in other words, Paul is making it pretty clear here. Listen, I have nothing to hide. These guys are accusing me, but the truth is, yeah, I might not be a very impressive looking person, but I'm not saying anything different than what I've written you in my letters.
Yeah, I really like that he says, look, even if I boast a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I will not be ashamed. So he does this thing. He's like, look, I don't know. Maybe I boast too much about this authority. I don't know. But I'm not even sorry about it. Okay. Maybe they say like, I don't know, man, he talks a lot about this apostolic authority. And he's like, I don't know. Maybe I do. But that aside, my letters are not meant to frighten you. Like they're telling you like, man, this guy is harsh in his rhetoric and he's using scare tactics. He's trying to like, he's using fear as a way of controlling you and of wielding power over you. And then he's saying like, and this is coming from an apostle, so you better listen. Paul said, none of that is the intention of these letters. I'm not trying to exercise some authority to scare you into submission or any such thing. And says like, look, I get it. When I show up, I'm not that impressive looking. I'm not that impressive sounding. Paul is a dude that you get the impression that he sounds much better on page than in person. So
indeed.
I know people like this that can write beautifully. And then if you put a microphone in their hand, they are scared to death or they're just not that eloquent, whatever it is. So, you know, basically he has some guys accusing him of being a little bit of a Wizard of Oz here. Like, oh yeah, it sounds like thunder and lightnings and everything like that. You rip back that curtain, you've seen it. He's just a frail guy that's not that eloquent. Yeah. And he's like, look, though that may be true, well, I am not playing some kind of game here.
Yeah. And by the way, it's vice versa. You know, you know people that can speak wonderfully, but they're not too strong on the page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it also is a thing. You know, it's not uncommon for preachers to think that because they can preach well, that they can write well, doesn't necessarily always translate. And this is, you know, Paul seems to be a guy, and obviously we know this because we've gone through so much of his writing in this podcast and in our ministries. We know that Paul can write. We know that Paul knows how to string together a really good, tight, logical case for Christian doctrine and for the gospel. But apparently, he just isn't too impressive in person.
Yeah,
this is a means by which they attack him.
Yeah, we see this, the sort of maybe the opposite of this with Apollos, who apparently is like the greatest preacher who ever lived, and we have no things written by him except for the transcript
except
of his letter Hebrews. Yeah,
except for
Hebrews. Hashtag personal opinion. But yeah, I mean, and even that, if that is indeed Apollos, which I think there's good arguments for. I am also just kind of partial to that for, I don't know why, I'm just drawn to that argument. But even if that is true, it's a transcript of a sermon. So,
that's right. By the way, I just think it's, you know, it shows a little bit of our nerdiness that we laugh at the idea of saying, ooh, Apollos was the author of Hebrews.
Yeah, we're dorks.
Complete nerds. But yeah, anyhow, so yeah, as we're saying, Paul is seen as weak because he's not so impressive in person. And so he continues verse 13, but we will not boast beyond limits, but will boast only with regard to the area of influence God assigned to us, to reach even to you. For we are not overextending ourselves as though we did not reach you. For we were the first to come all the way to you with the gospel of Christ. We do not boast beyond limit in the labors of others, but our hope is that as your faith increases, our area of influence among you may be greatly enlarged so that we may preach the gospel in lands beyond you without boasting of work already done in another's area of influence. Let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. For it is not the one who commends himself who is approved, but the one whom the Lord commends. Boom.
Yeah, this is nice.
So these guys, these super apostles, quote unquote, that he's going to dig into in just a little bit here, they all have commendations from each other. They actually, it was not uncommon for someone to show up with a letter of commendation when they wanted to preach, whether it be in a synagogue or in the early church here. And that letter of commendation was supposed to, it was basically a seal of authenticity. Paul's basically saying, yeah, they're all commending each other, this group of people, but those commendations don't mean anything for this ministry. What ultimately matters is the Lord's commendation, which I have. And why does Paul know he has it? Because he has seen the risen Christ, and the risen Christ has personally commissioned him for the ministry that he is participating in.
Yeah. I mean, and he's making the argument too that, look, do you guys remember like when we came in there and preached the gospel to you first? Like nobody, none of these guys were there. These guys have risen up basically. Like they've like climbed up on our back and tried to take this thing over. But like, do you remember that like we came there, like we weren't like asked to be there. We had to come there and preach the gospel in the streets, right? This is what we came there to do. And our whole goal was to plant a church and then leave and extend the gospel further. Like, you guys know this. You know that our whole, we're not trying to build empires here or capture power and authority. We're trying to get this gospel out further and further and further. And if you stop for a second and thought about it, you would know that that's true.
And yet ultimately, you know, what Paul says here is he says, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. So, and the reason Paul says that is because Paul wants to make it clear that he's not boasting about the strength of his ministry, quote unquote, or his success. He is simply boasting about what the Lord has done through him in creating this church and hopefully in creating more churches as his ministry continues. That's really the point of this paragraph at the end of chapter 10.
Yep.
And so he continues in chapter 11, I wish you would bear with me in a little foolishness. Do bear with me, for I feel a divine jealousy for you, since I betrothed you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. But I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaimed, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it readily enough. Indeed, I consider that I am not in the least inferior to these super apostles. Even if I am unskilled in speaking, I am not so in knowledge. Indeed, in every way, we have made this plain to you in all things. So now Paul is getting, I mean, you know, he even says here at the beginning, like, okay, bear with me, fellas. I'm going to say some harsh things here.
Well, even
I'm going to say some stuff that's difficult for you to hear.
Well, even, I mean, he says this like, bear with me a little foolishness. Paul is giving the caveat that he is going to get a little emotional. And then he lets the cat out of the bag again by saying, I feel jealous. And now I think it's a divine jealousy. This is what he calls it, right? It's a divine jealousy, but I feel jealous for you. That, like, I mean, I brought the gospel to you, and you believed, and you were in this one gospel, in this one Christ, and you got these people coming in, giving you something else, and yeah, I'm jealous about it.
The language here that he's using at the beginning is the language of a father handing his daughter off to be married mm-hmm. to someone. And then as he goes through his argument here, it's sort of the allusion to them cheating on the spouse that he had handed her over to. He had handed this church, her, the bride, over to Christ. And yet somebody else is coming in preaching a different Christ, a different spirit, a different gospel. And he says, you put up with it.
Yeah.
It's like you're unfaithful. It's like you're an unfaithful bride. And I'm jealous. I'm upset about this. This is why we've said many times, Dan, that this book is really maybe the most emotional of Paul's books, in which he just really wears his own heart on his sleeves. He is wounded here because of the way that they've just so been willing to kind of toss him to the side, dismiss him.
Yeah, I mean, and he says this, like, look, even if I'm unskilled in speaking, I am in no way inferior to these super apostles. and here's this thing. I mean, if you brought it down in the common language, he's like, these guys are smooth talkers, but they're dumb. these guys are saying a lot of things that sound good, but none of it's true. They might be more skilled with the tongue than me, but they are not more skilled in knowledge than me.
Well, and even at the end, when he says, indeed, in every way, we have made this plain to you in all things. I mean, this is a little boast. Like, you guys know I'm smart. You guys know I know what I'm talking about here. Like, come on. I've made it plain to you.
mm-hmm. Yes. I have made it real clear to you that I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's right. He continues, or did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted because I preached God's gospel to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do.
Yeah.
The super apostles, they seem to be actually taking money from the Corinthian church. They seem to be probably living pretty well based on the allusions that are made in this text from the Corinthian church. And part of what Paul makes his case for is like, now I'm being dismissed. Maybe I should have made money from you too.
Yeah. Well, what it is that Paul is saying, so I guess maybe it was a sin or maybe it was a mistake for me to come in all ragamuffin style. I should have come and given you the gospel and then demand that you elevate me according to worldly elevation. And so I should have been like, and now you all owe me a tenth of everything you make, and I'm going to be your king and spiritual ruler now, which is it seems to be what these super apostles are doing. He's like, I didn't do that. Like, I didn't come and ask you for anything. In fact, other churches were supporting me so that I could even be there. And then when I had need, there was other people that came with me. They were supplying my needs. I've never asked you guys for anything. Apparently, since you think these super apostles are so great and they're extracting all kinds of things from you, apparently that's some great sin to show up in this sort of humility. Now, of course, he's being sarcastic here. And then says, why did I come in the first place? Because I don't love you? Is that what it is? I don't love you? That's why I came, preached the gospel took nothing from you, have taken nothing from you. And I did that because I hate you.
Yeah.
That's absurd. Of course I love you. He's sort of like auditing everything they know. And he's like, if you just take a moment and like think back, you would know how preposterous this all is.
Yeah. And it's so rife with emotion, this passage. He's just clearly hurt by what they've done and by what they're willing to receive. And so he finishes off this brief section saying, and what I am doing, I will continue to do, in order to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim that in their boasted mission, they work on the same terms as we do. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. He's not pulling any punches. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds.
Yeah, yeah. This is pretty rough.
Well, he's not taking any prisoners, man. I mean, he is really, he's just calling them out. You know, these guys are charlatans, Paul says. They're charlatans. They're masquerading just as Satan does. They look attractive to you. You're falling for the bait. And let me just tell you very clearly, they are shysters. Run away from them. I'm not going to back down from saying that. If I have to compare them to Satan, because that's who this is being fueled by, then I will.
Yeah, I mean, so
really, really tough stuff.
Yeah, he is saying, listen, I mean, the idea here that I'm going to stop, like, hey, maybe just calm down a little bit here, right? He's like, I'm not going to stop until this whole thing is over and done with, because I am dead set to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim that their work is the same work that we're doing. It's not the same work. And then it goes on to say, in fact, it's the opposite work. It's the work of the devil.
Yeah.
And he's serving it up under the guise of righteousness. He's serving it up under the guise of light. And he's like, no, the devil is known to do this. And this is exactly what these guys are doing.
Yeah. So you can understand, I mean, as we hear the way that Paul is being, you know, thrown under the bus by the church there, you can understand his frustration. You can understand why he's coming after them. But ultimately, it's not even as hurt as Paul is here, Dan. It's really not even about Paul. Underlying this whole thing is he is genuinely afraid that the Corinthians are going to walk away from the gospel because of the influence of these guys. That's what Paul's biggest concern is. It's not even that they're slandering me. It's that they're slandering me is leading you to doubt the message that I preach
right,
to you.
Right.
And that is the problem I have.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, the one thing that we can take away from this too, is this sort of idea that I think that we think that Satan's going to show up in the occult. You know, I mean, like, well, Satan is so obvious. It's dark. It's foreboding. It's evil. Yeah. And like, man, you know Darth Vader when you see him, you know? And so it's not like this at all. What the devil likes to do is come up and serve up something that looks a lot like righteousness. And that's what he said, right? I mean, he says they will disguise themselves as servants of righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the most dangerous stuff happens when it comes to teaching, when it comes to knowledge of God, comes from people who you would think, well, I mean, these guys seem like they're really concerned with righteousness.
Yeah.
Throughout church history, all of the corruptions have been done this way. Grab some power, make some crazy statements about what people have to do to be right with God. And you're like, well, I mean, why would they lie?
Usually cults thrive in times where the church appears to be corrupted or unrighteous, and people get frustrated with it. They get frustrated with the sin and the imperfection that they see in the church. And some charismatic leader rises up and says, the church has been too corrupted and I've got the right way. It just so happens, Dan, I've been on a cult documentary kick lately. I just watched one on Heaven's Gate. I just watched one on Jim Jones. I mean, I've just been sort of fascinated by this recently. And, you know, the question that comes all the time is like, how could somebody fall for this? How could somebody fall into this trap? Well, folks, don't ever believe that these people are much different than any of us. That people are very prone to, especially in the name of righteousness, fall after these teachings, you know, by some charismatic leader. It's not it there, but by the grace of God, go we.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's people that are like, wait, isn't that what Luther did? The answer to that question is no. Well, he did the opposite of this, where he said, hey, all this righteousness game you're playing, I was looking at the scriptures, turns out that is not the path to God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, that it's his righteousness.
Yeah, just stick with the people that are telling you it's Christ and Christ alone all day, every day, and you'll be all right.
Yeah, that's right. Amen to that.
All right, and that is it. We are out of time. We will be back next week to wrap up chapter 11. Eric, I'll see you then.
Sounds good.